Freedom News Hour with Walt Thiessen, Jake Towne, and Gene DiNardo. Thursdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Don't you know we're talking about a revolution sounds?
It's the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown, and I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Gene DiNardo on this Thursday, November 17, 2011, and here are some of the headlines we're watching today. You would not believe the cost of holding a prisoner in Guantanamo Bay, but Leon Panetta, meanwhile, whines about the possible defense cuts that he's facing. Herman Cain announces that God made him run for president. That should come as no surprise to some people. The price of a Thanksgiving dinner up 13%. Meanwhile, the Iowa caucuses are now a four-way race. Guess who's in the middle of it? Labor Department, I have some doubts about that, but we'll be talking about that in a little more detail. J.P. Morgan continues to keep the public in the dark about how much exposure they have to Italy and Greece. Meanwhile, the housing crisis continues to get worse, and it's getting to the point where the FHA may become the next required bailout organization. Protesters march nationwide in the Occupy Wall Street movement, and over 200 are arrested. But the big news this week continues to be what the news has been all along, the ongoing growing European debt crisis. And, Gene, it just keeps getting worse and worse as we keep expecting here on the program. We've been predicting this for months, and the news media are finally picking up on it. But let me just go over some of the latest news that's coming out. This from the Associated Press. Global stocks slid further today as investors worried that the debt crisis was intensifying and spreading to larger countries in the 17-nation eurozone. Bond investors pushing up borrowing rates for Spain and also for France, where the spread, or extra yield, demanded compared to safe haven German bonds widened to a record 2 percentage points. That's very significant. Meanwhile, Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel again brushed aside pressure for a quick-fix solution to the euro crisis, despite the mounting market tensions. Quick-fix, by the way, that would mean printing money, arguing that spreading debt liability could ruin Europe's competitiveness and a massive European central bank bond buying drive wouldn't resolve its problems. Well, she got that part right. Meanwhile, also in Italy, the problems have become particularly bad as the current rate on Italian bonds is up to 7%. This is a huge amount for what is not what is the third largest economy in the eurozone. This is basically a reflection of the fact that the credit markets are freezing up. Fewer and fewer people are willing to buy the debt. A lot more people thinking that the whole thing's going to go south very soon. Gene, it doesn't look any better than it did last week.
Prime Minister, right.
Yeah, but he does have a central banking background, which, of course, makes him a great politician.
Yeah, that's what I heard a speech when he was claiming that there were no politicians. You know, we're not going to have politicians running the country. And I think, well, he's a banker. I mean,
but you know that your government's off to a bad start when the very first thing you have is a vote of confidence.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's not good where a parliamentary system is concerned. You want that to come later on down the line, not as your first action.
And you mentioned France was in trouble, too.
Yeah, well, France is not at the fore of the problems, but they are becoming more and more involved in it, mainly because two of the largest banks in the world are in France, and
right.
Those banks are heavily invested in the eurozone, particularly in the so-called PIGS countries. And just to remind our viewers, the PIGS countries are Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Spain, and Greece. I actually should have said Greece and Spain. That way it would spell out PIGS. But, yes, France is very heavily invested. And, in fact, I made mention as I was quickly jotting through the headlines that J.P. Morgan is refusing to acknowledge how much exposure they have over in Europe. The only thing they've been able to, or not able, the only thing they've been willing to reveal this week is that they have sold protection on more than $5 trillion of debt globally, but they won't specify how much of that debt was issued by Greece, Italy, Ireland, Portugal, and Spain.
Hmm.
So, yeah. Basically,
means they have a lot. Because why would
right?
Why would they worry about mentioning it if they didn't?
That's right. The article too that I saw that in. This is a Bloomberg article. That article was almost humorous. If you can actually see a humorous side to this whole thing, because they basically went out of their way to come up with experts who explained that it is almost impossible for J.P. Morgan to let people know how much exposure they have in the PIGS countries.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Impossible.
Everybody who believes that, raise your right hand.
Yeah. They don't really know where their loans are.
Well, apparently, the trading is, and the record keeping that's associated with that is so complex.
It's very
complex.
There's
really no way to add it all up.
And, you know, once they get past a couple million, they stop keeping track of this. They're not like regular folks.
No, they don't actually do things like keep budgets, you know.
Yeah, right, budgets.
Budget, what's that?
The France thing kind of makes sense now that you say that. I've always thought they were more of a creditor, in the world situation, more of a creditor country. And
yet it's already beginning to affect them because, as the article that I quoted, that was actually from the Washington Post business section, but it was a Bloomberg article as well. And in that article, they were saying that the bond investors have been pushing up rates for Spain and for France, and particularly it's showing up in the spread. That spread is really important because the larger that spread gets, that's the difference between the asking price and the offering price for the bonds, the larger that spread gets, the harder it is to close the gap and actually make a sale.
Actually fund them.
Actually trade it. So when that gap gets particularly large, that's basically where they say the whole thing is frozen up and there's no longer a market for the bonds.
Yeah, and basically they need these new loans to pay off the old ones.
Exactly. Yeah, it's an ongoing Ponzi scheme more than anything else.
But, yeah, so that at some point people say, well, I don't know. There's too many loans being paid off and not paid off.
And you also have to realize that the main buyers of these, the main buyers are not people like you and me.
Right.
The main buyers are the other banks around the world. This is one of the reasons why they're so concerned. What's the big word where the European debt crisis is concerned? It's contagion. This whole idea. Now, there's a word for you. Think about that one. They use a word that makes it sound like that, you know, Italy caught a cold.
It's a virus. Right?
It's a virus, and you know, France is afraid they're going to get it, and they're going to lose work for a week, you know?
Which they'll enjoy in France.
But it's a totally ridiculous and misleading word, this whole idea of a contagion.
Yeah.
What it really means is everybody's lending and debt handling is so heavily interlocked that when one goes down, a whole bunch of them go down like dominoes. That's what they really mean by contagion.
Yeah, if it gets back to too big to fail,
yeah,
how everything's tied in.
Yeah, which, I mean, really, there's nothing that's too big to fail. We've seen that.
Yeah.
But ultimately, that's what they're talking about. And the threat that's behind all this is the claim that if they do fail, that the entire economy just comes crashing to a halt.
Yeah.
Which our story last week about, what was it, Iceland, I think it was, or Finland?
They lost their three major banks, and they were fine. In fact, they had 4% unemployment. And, we've talked about the banking sector here, which grew from 3% of the financial revenue of the entire country in the 60s, and now it's at 40. The financial sector is at 40 or 45%, and that seems a bit much to me.
Yeah, it's certainly higher than it was, say, a generation ago. No doubt about that.
It's not that long ago, and it's just not healthy. And there is I wish I could think of the name of it. There's a great book that traces the history of six or eight different empires, and it talks about how the empires went from basically making stuff or having other people make it and taking it and transferring that and then eventually evolving into a banking empire. And, you know, England was the last. That's the last one they analyzed. And then he predicted, of course, that the American one would do the same thing. It's kind of the end of these empires once you get to the financial stage because you're not doing that much that's productive, I guess, is the point anyway.
There's a little bit of truth to that. I think the more important truth to take away from it is when you look at the history, for instance, you mentioned Britain and the end of the British domination of the financial era, of the financial world. That basically came in the 1920s,
right.
Following World War One and leading up to the great market crash. And during the 1920s, what was happening is that the British Empire was basically bankrupt. I mean, for all intents and purposes, it was bankrupt. And since we were still nominally, anyway, on the gold standard, even though the banks and the governments were doing everything they could to undermine it. But the bottom line was the gold standard was still placing a drag on the ability of the British Empire to continue to borrow and live beyond its means, which, of course, you know, politicians hate because then they can't keep making their promises to their constituents.
And get elected, right?
Absolutely. So the British banking system, the British government, placed a lot of pressure on the American banking system and the American government, which had not yet run up nearly as much debt and had not yet expanded their money supply as much as the European powers had. And so the net result was that the dollar was relatively sound. Actually, it wasn't really sound because J.P. Morgan and his crew had already been ramping things up, first leading up to World War One and the conclusion of World War One, and then with the so-called Reconstruction and all that other stuff. But it was basically an era where the American monetary system was expanding slower than everybody else's, so we were financially stronger, which is a weird
relative
way to say
it. Sense, right?
Yeah, these things are all relative. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line was a whole bunch of American gold ended up going across the channel to Great Britain to help cover all this massive debt that they were trying to engage in, and basically all that gold disappeared into the marketplace. Mm-hmm. But they tried to pretend that it hadn't really done that, and the net result was that even though they were trying to send all the gold there, the gold ended up working its way back to the United States because that's where the stronger currency was.
Funny.
And it is funny. It's funny in sort of a tragic sort of way.
Yeah.
But ultimately, that led to the American boom, the Roaring Twenties, and helped fund the Roaring Twenties with all the overinvestment in the stock market and all that kind of thing. And that ultimately crested and peaked in the early part of 1929. And by October 1929, boom, it was on its way back down again. I should say bust.
Led us right into the Depression, right?
Well, the Depression actually didn't hit until a couple years later, but that was the forerunner of it.
Right, right.
Very similar to a certain financial crisis I can think of that happened, say, 3 years ago. You know, we have this big crisis, where's the recession, they said, in 2008. You know, everybody was worried about it, but there was no recession. Well, you had to wait a little bit, and there it is.
Yeah, I start to hear, we heard the double dip about, 5-6 months ago, and then it kind of went away, and then I've heard a couple people mention it again with the European thing coming on, that it could force everybody into the double dip. And
The double dip is actually already here. They just haven't acknowledged it yet. And it's important to understand the reason they can get away with not acknowledging it is because they're working with these elastic monetary supplies. So that the more they keep expanding the money supply and they keep spending it through government spending and all this kind of thing, the more they can make it look like we're not in recession.
Right, right.
But when you're actually looking at it from the point of view of, say, real money, something that actually retains its value, you know, like a precious metal or oil or something like that, what you find is, we're in recession. The whole world's in recession.
We've been in bad shape for decades.
but we have numerically been in recession since the early part of the 2000s, and that's really the key thing.
And I think most people realize that just by their loss of
anyone doesn't work for the government, you know.
Yeah. Then you're always in a great spot.
And the government, of course, is very good at least publicly feigning confusion and surprise at times shocking the heck out of us. In fact, you have a very interesting, shocking story about just how expensive it is for the government to maintain its Guantanamo installation. What are the details on that?
Yeah, this story is it's phenomenal, I think. The financial cost of Guantanamo, there's only 171 inmates. The annual cost for the American taxpayer, believe it or not, $800,000 per inmate.
Oof.
And it starts off kind of timid here. It says each of the inmates, gets $38.45 worth of food a day. So that doesn't seem too unreasonable.
Well, the $800,000 minus $34.
Yeah, how much is left? I'll read some of it. The Pentagon Detention Center, that started out in January 2002 as a collection of crude open-air cells guarded by Marines in a muddy tent city, is today arguably the most expensive prison on Earth, costing taxpayers $800,000 annually for each of the 171 captives. This was rung up by the Obama administration figures. That's more than 30 times the cost of keeping a captive on U.S. soil. Congress, charged now with cutting $1.5 trillion from the budget by Christmas, provided $139 million to operate the center just last year. It has made every effort to keep it open, even as former deputy commander of the detention center calls it expensive and inefficient. At Guantanamo, everything comes in by barge or aircraft from paperclips to bulldozers, as well as a revolving guard force. So they're changing their guard force now. With no strategy for meeting President Barack Obama's January 22, 2009 closure order, the military is preparing for the prison's next decade. Spending is not just aimed at upgrades for the captive population, most in medium security confinement, but also for the revolving staff of 1,850 troops, linguists, intelligence analysts, federal agents, and contract laborers. Commanders are contracting for a new round of capital improvements, including $2 million worth of computer equipment. That doesn't include the unnetworked laptops the prison provides captives taking a life skills class that includes a resume writing lesson in case anyone gets to go home. Unbelievable. Meantime, the Guard Force commander is getting a new 3,000 to 3,500 square foot headquarters at the prison camps for what is predicted to cost less than $750,000, which is below the amount that Congress needs to sign off. Coincidentally, the military is also spending up to $750,000 to replace the aging, rusting prison camp hospital with a new infirmary hub and expeditionary medical shelters around the prison camps. Equipping the new hospital will cost more, so the Navy Medical Logistics Command has put out a bid for everything from microscopes to resuscitators. The price of this is unknown. As far as the people who work there, a guard with 4 years in the Navy with the rank of Petty Officer Third Class gets $2,985 a month, including the same hazardous duty pay as in Kabul, so they're paying them hazardous duty. A Navy commander with 15 years but no kids gets $7,840 a month, including the hazardous pay. Prison staffers have their own gym, housing and newsletter, dining rooms, and first-run movie theater at Camp America adjacent to the camps. They have their own chapel, mental health services, and mini-mart. Captors and captors also have their own kitchen, health services, transportation, and security services, all fueled by a steady supply line. Pentagon contract workers maintain a 24,000 title book, video, and magazine library and are building yet another soccer field for cooperative captives. We are running a 5-star resort and not a detention facility for terrorists, said Florida Republican Representative Alan West. For example, why do they need 24 cable TV channels? And the Defense Department spends approximately $150 million per year on detention operations at Guantanamo, currently at a rate of more than $800,000 per detainee. Attorney General Eric Holder and Defense Secretary Leon Panetta and other cabinet members wrote Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell and others. Meanwhile, our federal prisons spend a little over $25,000 per year per prisoner, and federal courts and prosecutors routinely handle numerous terrorist cases a year well within their operating budget. So there is some criticism within the administration.
But I have to tell you, I mean, leaves like a warm glow in my heart to know that despite the fact that we are violating the U.S. Constitution, violating international law by maintaining this prison camp, we're going out of our way to make sure that they can play soccer. I feel so good about that.
We're violating it in the right way.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Good grief. Well,
isn't that amazing?
It's just disgusting is what it is.
It is. I mean, and, you know, it gets entrenched, and, of course, they're going to fight any effort to close it.
And the worst part, of course, is we know that this is a tiny drop in the bucket compared to the rest of spending that goes on in the defense industry. And, in fact, what you were mentioning, Leon Panetta, isn't he been the one whining about what's been going on in terms of potentially cutting the budget? Oh, my God.
Yeah, the same guy, the same exact guy. He's criticizing that. Well, before I go to that, I noticed something here. 171 inmates, and the workers have 247 kids. There's more kids than inmates.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I guess it's what's known as a kid-friendly environment.
It's a kid. Yeah, I don't think so. Can you imagine it growing up there? It's,
oh, my God.
Some stories. Yeah, Panetta, he details the impact of cuts. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta warned Congress on Monday that deeper defense cuts would leave the military with the smallest ground force since 1940 and force the Pentagon to recalibrate its national security strategy to accept substantial risk. The Pentagon is already facing 400...
Wait a minute. The smallest ground force since 1940?
Yeah, that's what it says.
Are you kidding?
Okay, let me skip down to see what else he said. Okay, by his calculations, this is along the same lines.
I mean, two thoughts come to my mind about that. First of all, 1940 was 1 year before we entered the war.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's this massive increase. Is that what he's thinking about? You know, we got to think in terms of this massive increase.
The year before the war, right?
That's the first thought that comes to my mind. Then the second thought is he out of his mind?
Yeah, the second thought is probably still not true when you think, could it be?
Sorry.
I don't think so. But anyway, here's what else he says. By his calculations, if these cuts went through, we would have the smallest ground force since 1940, the smallest number of ships since 1915, and the smallest air force in its history. How can you have the smallest air force in its history? Does that mean the first year they had more planes? I can't believe that. I think we probably have more planes that don't work.
Well, I'm trying to think. How many planes did they have at Lexington and Concord?
How about Gettysburg? Let's see. While painting a dire picture of the military, if the automatic cuts are triggered, Panetta also implored the lawmakers to stave off such reductions. If they did not, the Pentagon chief said the military would have to rethink its strategy. Now, that'd be terrible. We would have to formulate a new security strategy that accepted substantial risk of not meeting our defense needs, whatever that means. In his letter, Panetta said that deeper reductions would affect the military's ability to support the war in Afghanistan and lead to a fleet of fewer than 230 ships, again, the smallest number since 1915. So apparently we had more than 230 in 1915. I guess that's possible. I don't
know.
Anyway.
I got a question. Now, I don't remember the exact numbers, but if I remember correctly, just kind of ballparking, you know, the defense budget is somewhere like, you know, $600 to $800 billion, something like that, somewhere in that range.
Right. Not including Homeland Security.
So if we're going to be having to reduce the military down to the numbers that are the smallest since 1940, doesn't that imply that the defense budget should be cut by like 90%?
Well, you know, the cuts they're doing, whenever they talk about cuts, they just talk about cutbacks in increased spending. You know, I mean, I had another thing on Medicare, and they're talking about all these cuts to Medicare, and really they're just talking about savings in future increases in spending. I mean,
well,
it's totally
true, but
delusionary.
But I mean, his argument doesn't even make any sense to me, because if what he's saying is true, if what he's saying is true that we're going to be cutting back on everything so much, it's this massive cutback, then there should also be a corresponding massive cutback in defense spending. And yet my understanding is the defense cut would be relatively small compared to that. So where's the rest of the money going?
Where is it going? And yeah.
That to me is just a staggering, gigantic elephant in the room where his argument is concerned. Personally, I wouldn't mind having the military cut down like that. It would be a good reason to bring everybody home, which is what we need to do in the first place anyway. But even if we accept his argument to be true, where's the money going?
Well, you know, and they're not even, I think, Obama's been criticized because he's actually proposed some cuts, but his cuts are not cuts either. They're just decreases in spending, and he's increased, you know, I think we talked about this about 3 weeks ago. He's increased spending, you know, every year on the military. I don't understand why it's a sacred cow. I mean, other than the fact that, you know, I don't know how many people are tied into the military welfare, and that's part of it. But
that's certainly a big part, because a lot of people earn their living, or I should say collect their paychecks from the military. There's no doubt about that.
And just like we mentioned on any government job, you know, it's great security, and the pay is just so, you know, it's non-competitive for the most part. Most of those bids are non-competitive. It's just, the whole thing's goofy, and it's sad, and, you know, I hope the cuts do go through. That's why I'm kind of hoping they don't come to an agreement with the super committee.
Well, I think there's actually a good chance of that. But from what I've been reading, it sounds like the people who are involved in the super committee directly, the representatives who are directly on the committee, themselves are not saying that they think there's going to be anything good coming out of it, that they think the whole thing is just going to come grinding to a halt and they're going to hit the deadline.
Yeah, and I saw it's a national liberal commentator. I can't remember his name, but it was in today's paper, and he has a column, and he was saying that he thought that would be a good idea. He says, I hope they don't come to any agreement, because it's probably the best cuts in defense that we'll have, because nobody in Congress is going to propose the cuts that will go through automatically. Of course, you know, they've been talking about reversing them anyway, but...
Wouldn't that be ironic, though, if the only time that we ever actually had significant defense cuts was because Congress couldn't agree?
Yeah, it'd be funny.
That would be really
great.
Something. Yeah, it would be good, and be really interesting to see what the fallout is, especially in light of Panetta's comments. I mean, I'm just sitting here in awe at his ability to just lie, you know, off the top of his head.
Yeah.
Because the whole, correct me if I'm wrong, but they're talking about defense cuts of like, what, 20 or 30% or something like that. And yet he's talking about a military that is, if we understand his hyperbole, it is so small that it would absolutely be dwarfed by the current military. Well, that sounds like to me a lot more than a 20% cut in defense spending.
Yeah, I'm sure it's a cut in increases. It's got to be.
But if it's a cut in increases, how do you justify the fact that the force is so small? That's the thing that gets me.
Well, you know, inflation.
I mean, if it's really such a tiny military, by the time we're done, we should have a tiny defense budget to go with it.
You think so? It kind of reminds me of when you have budget issues locally, you know, and they say, we're going to, you know, if you guys don't vote this through, we're going to have to get rid of 100 policemen or 100 firemen. You know, they always throw that out, and then it ends up they don't. And you know what happened around here about 4 years ago? Is they went through that whole thing, and so they said, oh, okay, we're going to have to get rid of this many. Well, what they really meant is they actually were scheduled to hire like another 50 new police officers the next year, and they were going to actually not hire 40 of them. Well, then what did they do? You know, it didn't go through, so they made it, you know, they said, well, it's going to be a terrible city, you know, the crime everywhere. So they actually increased the overtime pay of the existing officers, and they spent more on labor on that year than the year before with less officers.
Good grief.
I know. It's like a nightmare.
Well, yes, it is a nightmare. It's our nightmare, and welcome to it. We're going to be going to break in a couple minutes, but before we do, I want to touch on something that I've been... Well, I kind of wanted to touch on it earlier, but this has been such an engaging topic that we've been using up our time. But big news that came out of the Occupy Wall Street movement this week. Protesters basically marched nationwide, among other things, protesting the breakup of all the encampments by the police of the various cities. Over 200 people have been reported arrested today. And they basically were marching into towns and cities and parks all around the country, basically shouting out things like all week shut down Wall Street, and thousands more demonstrators are now gathering near New York Stock Exchange today, and they were sitting down in intersections. This is becoming a lot more than just a little bit of civil disobedience. This is becoming a major confrontation.
Yeah, I did read today was a big day. They did evict the Portland occupiers last weekend. I think they arrested 50, and they did it with a lot of notice and a lot of talk, and they kind of made it as peaceful as possible, I think, on both sides, and there was like one injury of a protester. But they're like you said, they are marching today, and they have been back, although I'm not sure if they're camping anywhere. I don't think they're doing the camping thing anymore, but I'm not certain on that.
I did see one note that said, I think this was having to do with protesters at Berkeley, and the one of the protesters was saying that we're not here to camp, we're here to occupy. But he didn't make a distinction about what the difference was between the two, because there were tents all over the main field at Berkeley. So not quite sure what they're saying.
Yeah, that's, you know, here what they did is went to Portland State University, and I think they do have some tents set up there, and the school actually allowed them to do that. It's an interesting idea, the occupation thing. You know, it's kind of what they're about, I guess.
Well, yeah, pretty much it is.
Yeah.
But
it's
anyway.
Different, you know. I wouldn't have thought of it.
Well, we're going to take a break, and after the break, we're going to have more to talk about, including the price of Thanksgiving. I got to talk about that right after the break. That one's just going to knock your socks off. Plus, our favorite politician is now in the top tier of the race, and that's official. Even the top news agencies are mentioning that, so we're going to touch on that. Plus, we'll be talking more about the ongoing housing crisis and the likelihood that, or the possibilities anyway, that the Federal Housing Authority may end up getting taken over or at least bailed out. So we'll be touching on that. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network. We will be back after these messages.
Don't you know you better run, run, run.
We're back here at the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, and as I mentioned before the break, well, first of all, I want to remind you, you can always check out our website, www.freedomnewshour.com, to find out the latest and greatest, find out if we have any guests, see what's going on with past episodes, listen to archived podcasts and so on and so forth, and be sure to check that out. But before the break, I mentioned that Thanksgiving, of course, is coming up. That'll be next week. And, in case you're wondering, we will be on the air, but we won't personally be on the air. We'll be running, PRN will be running last week's show where we interviewed Courtney Armstrong about her very unusual and interesting approach to treating PTSD, and where we also reported on the CTFC admitting that, yes, the silver market has been manipulated. So if you missed that program, you want to check that next week. But, of course, Gene and I will be digging into our Thanksgiving dinners just like everybody else. And, Gene, you'll be amazed to know just how much the price of a Thanksgiving dinner has gone up this year.
Wow.
This came from the Los Angeles Times, an article that they wrote entitled "The Price of a Thanksgiving Dinner is Up 13%. And let me just read a few lines from it. This is really interesting. Diners may not be in a thankful mood as they sit down in a few days to a Thanksgiving dinner that costs 13% more than it did last year. The price of a classic holiday meal for 10 people will hit $49.20, jumping from $43 to $47 in 2010. That, according to the American Farm Bureau Federation. Excuse me, that's the highest increase since 1990 as the cost of sweet potatoes, rolls, stuffing, and even whipped cream spiked this year. Bad weather, rising commodity prices, and other factors have caused a run-up in food and beverage prices over the last few months. On November 24th, a 30-ounce can of pumpkin pie mix will cost 16% more than it did last year, the farm group said. A pound of frozen green beans will be 17% more expensive, while a cost of a gallon of whole milk will jump 13%. But the biggest increase will be the turkey. A 16-pound bird is expected to run $21.57, or 22% more than in 2010. Economists with the farm group pegged the leap to strong demand in the U.S. and abroad. Retailers are being more aggressive about passing on higher costs for shipping, processing, and storing food to consumers. That says that according to John Anderson, a senior economist with the group. And the report said the Federation is an informal gauge of price trends around the nation. So this is not a Bureau of Labor Statistics report. This is actually an independent group giving us, my goodness, an honest reading on what's going on with the economy. Now, simultaneous to this article coming out, there's another article that came out this week. This from AOL Money Daily Finance that said, we'd rather buy iPhones and video games than clothes or gas, according to retail sales data. And this is based on the data that comes from the Department of Commerce. Overall retail sales rose 0.6% in October. Okay, do the math. 0.6% over 12 months, that's 7.2%. That's a pretty big increase.
That's huge, yeah.
Beating analyst estimates. But guess what? They're reporting in the article that prices are going down.
How do they do that?
It's amazing. I mean, the ways that they manipulate the data to basically say whatever they want to say is just absolutely amazing. And the point of this article is that, according to the numbers coming out of the government, more money is being spent literally on iPhones and video games than on food and gas. And the only way you can come to that conclusion, this is to me the most important thing about this article, not so much that the article is reporting this stuff that's just, you know, bonkers, but the data and the way that data is being presented shows very clear, this is about as clear as we've gotten so far, that the Bureau of Labor Statistics is fudging the numbers to make it look like whatever they want it to look like, so that even in the face of the fact that a Thanksgiving dinner costs 13% more than it did last year, they can still claim that Americans are irresponsibly spending all their money on video games and iPhones, and that is the real cause of whatever price increases we're having.
That's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. And at some point, the American people have to stand up and say, hey, Washington, you're full of it. How about giving us some real information for a change instead of trying to pull the wool over our eyes?
Either that or they just don't even pay attention. You know, I mean, they pay
attention. Well, that already happens.
Yeah. They just dismiss it as whatever. And, you know, I think when they go to the grocery store, they know what's going on. You know what I noticed at we normally buy, I don't know, you know, not the basic turkey, you know, the cheapest turkey, but more of a farm-based, you know, system turkey, whatever, you know. But anyway, so we went to Winco, which is a pretty low-cost place, and I noticed that the turkeys, which last year were more like 89 cents a pound, were like $1.19, and that's quite an increase, and that's that's your basic low-end retailer for food.
And that is much more realistic in terms of what we're seeing, I would say.
Yeah, and I think people realize, you know, people look at that and they know that's happening. They don't, even though it happens incrementally, you know, it doesn't happen all at once. And I don't even think they pay attention to the government figures, tell you the truth.
Well, I guess I would need to put some sort of a positive spin on it. I guess the positive spin is, like you say, they're not paying attention, which means that the government's credibility is eroding very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I suppose, is a good thing, because the more the government's credibility erodes, the less that the government is able to do to try to pull more wool over our eyes. Doesn't mean that the American people aren't gullible enough to be, you know, fooled anyway, because clearly that's been happening just by, you can tell from reading the news that that's been happening. But nevertheless, maybe that's what the silver lining is. The fact is that the government is becoming so truly non-credible that it's going to be very difficult for even its most fervent supporters to believe it anymore.
Oh, I agree. I mean, when you look at the approval ratings of the Congress at below 10%, and I don't think anybody believes them anymore. I mean, and the stuff they say is so out to lunch. It's so crazy. You know, you wonder how they could have ever believed them, but I think most people think they're not telling the truth, whether it's released from the federal government or even just, you know, particular politicians. I think people are smart enough to know that. And on the other hand, I don't think they really pay attention that much. You know, they just kind of dismiss it as talk or spin. Marketing.
That's what it is.
Marketing.
Marketing, yes.
That's what it is. Got to keep the business going.
But think about that for a second. What is it that they're marketing?
Before we get ill,
let's move on to the next topic.
Yeah, really.
And the next topic is, speaking of politicians, speaking of Congress being in single digits in approval ratings and politicians being held in uniform disdain, have you heard the news coming out of Iowa this past week?
No.
Well, let me tell you, Bloomberg News reported this. This came from a poll conducted by the same company that does the polling for the Des Moines Register. And this particular poll found, all possible surprises, there is a four-way dead heat for the Republican nomination in the Iowa caucuses.
Well, that is news, yeah.
And guess who is in the midst of it?
I got to say, I would say Romney, Kane, Ron Paul, four. Would it be Perry?
Gingrich, believe it or not.
Oh, that's right. That's
Newt
right.
Gingrich.
That's right. I just heard that too.
Perry and Michelle Bachmann are in the low single digits.
I wonder why.
6% and 7%. I mean, it's like the flavors of the month from past months basically just took a nosedive.
Yeah, exactly.
And even Mitt Romney's on the way down. He was up quite a bit and possibly higher than even his campaign had hoped for, because, of course, he got crushed in Iowa 4 years ago, and his own campaign admits that it was because of mistakes that they made. They're trying to avoid those same mistakes this time around, but he's now down below the 20% level as well. Here's what the numbers are. Herman Cain, 20%, Ron Paul, 19%, Mitt Romney, 18%, and Newt Gingrich at 17%. So all four of them are within the margin for error.
So it's possible Ron Paul could actually win that one.
And that's the thing that is absolutely not only astonishing and horrifying to the Republican elite, but it's so horrifying that the major media, for the most part, are still trying to pretend that Ron Paul is the invisible candidate.
Yeah, they don't pay attention to
it. No, they're just not willing to report on it. CBS News, who, I don't know if you heard about this one, CBS News was actually involved in the latest big debate that the Republicans had, that most people, of course, don't watch, but nevertheless, they had the big debate, and 90 minutes of that debate, guess how much airtime Ron Paul had?
Not enough.
89 seconds.
No!
Yes.
That's unbelievable.
89 seconds.
You know where Ron Paul got the most airtime? When Perry was mentioning how many, you know, he's going to cut three agencies of the government.
And he can't remember what the third
two.
One is.
So Ron Paul had five fingers up, didn't he?
Yeah.
And he was right next to him. I didn't understand that because I didn't watch the whole debate. But
well, he had the five fingers up because he had proposed cutting five departments.
He was proposed cutting five, and I bet he knew which ones they were.
Oh, of course he did, yes. And he actually, to his credit, did not come down hard on Perry for forgetting what the third department was.
Yeah,
people make mistakes and so forth.
I wouldn't expect
it. But it was the media who came down on Perry for that one.
Well, a lot of people are saying, okay, you know, he just went brain dead. You know, they're tired. I think the problem is he doesn't think these things through. People are telling him what to say.
Of course.
That's what I would say. He doesn't even have, you know,
which actually is brain dead when you think about it.
Yeah, you're right. So I guess they're right.
Yeah. But, yeah, definitely the big news is that Paul is right in the thick of it. And
that's
that was
great.
Not supposed to happen. That basically is what all of the experts have been telling us cannot happen and would not happen and will not happen.
If he actually won, they would at least have to pay some attention to him.
That's actually going to be interesting to see, because if he does win, and frankly, he's got a great chance right now, because Kane is on the way down. I mean, that sexual harassment thing is not going away. His numbers have been falling. Romney is falling, certainly in Iowa. The only other candidate who rose besides Paul was Newt Gingrich, and that strikes me as another, you know, skyrocket that's going to go up and down again. So Paul has a really good chance of actually winning the Iowa caucuses outright. So that does raise a very interesting question. If he does manage to win the Iowa caucuses, what happens to media coverage? Because I don't think it's a given that he starts getting it.
No, I don't think so. I think how they'll have to cover it, because, of course, he won to some extent. But I think what they'll say is it's just a freak occurrence. You know, this just happened because Kane was losing popularity and et cetera, et cetera. And
yet the really interesting part about this particular survey is not only was it conducted by the same company that does the surveying for the Des Moines Register, whose numbers, by the way, are also what most of the media follow when it's a non-Ron Paul candidate.
Yeah.
Anybody but Ron Paul, then they'll pay close attention to the numbers. But as soon as Ron Paul's in there, then, you know, they dismiss the numbers. But it's also really important to note, most of the time when the major media outlets are reporting, you know, what the horse race is, they're doing it on a national level. And national level numbers are meaningless. The reason they're meaningless is most of the population aren't yet familiar with the candidates. The only populations that have significant exposure to the candidates are Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, the early primary states, because that's where the candidates are focusing their campaign attention. So somebody in Kansas or Alaska or Arizona, for the most part, hasn't been paying much attention to the race, so they don't even know who the candidates are.
No, that's true, and again, it's they don't pay attention until the, you know, right
until it shows up in their own state.
Yeah, and Kane has been falling. I don't know. You probably saw his comments on Libya.
Oh yes,
that was pretty funny.
he's proving
Libya.
That it's one thing to run Godfather Pizza.
Yeah, it's not quite a different thing to know where these countries are.
Oh my goodness, it's
and
almost like another Michelle Bachmann,
saying,
you know?
I think he ended up by saying he didn't understand. He didn't really know what Obama did in Libya or something like that.
But I want to get back to the poll results, because there's some more interesting information in there. Among other really solid pieces of information coming out of that poll is the fact that the one candidate who has the strongest support among the people who said they were going to support him, in other words, voters who said that their minds are made up and they're not going to change their mind, who do you think the leader is?
Ron Paul,
32%. Romney, 25%. Gingrich, half of Paul's total at 17%, is third. And then among Paul supporters who supported him in the 2008 caucuses, 69% are still with him now. Additionally, though, the main difference, of course, with something like Iowa and, say, Kansas, like we just touched on, is the fact that the voters are much more exposed to the candidates. And the poll actually asked questions of the respondents, how many of the, you know, which of the candidates have you heard from? Guess who led all candidates in terms of name recognition and the voters having heard from them?
Well, I would be really surprised if it's Ron Paul.
It's Ron Paul.
Wow.
Two-thirds of the respondents had heard from Ron Paul.
Now, do you think this is just, they just intensified their campaign efforts? Or?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. All the money that the Paul campaign has been raising has been going directly into the early primary states. Not all of it, large portions of it have been going there,
though.
That's
probably a good idea.
Oh, absolutely. And they have the most extensive campaign operations of any of the candidates. I mean, Romney has raised a lot more money, but his campaign is not nearly as strongly established in all the leading states as the Paul campaign is. And that's really very significant because, as we all know, it really comes down to how well organized your campaign is in terms of how likely you are going to be able to get the people out supporting your candidate at the polls.
Yeah.
That's really, really big.
Yeah, these guys, you know, if they actually really have to debate Ron Paul, they won't have a chance.
Yeah, well, that's just it.
Yeah.
They don't want to have to debate him. They want to limit it to a soundbite competition.
Soundbite, right.
Yeah. More information about the particular poll. Very interesting stuff. Guess who came in second place in terms of how much exposure the voters have had to this particular candidate? You'll never guess this one.
I would guess Newt.
Nope. It's actually Michelle Bachmann.
Huh.
61% had exposure to her, but that 61% only turned into 6% support for her, whereas Ron Paul's two-thirds exposure got him 19% of the voters.
Well, that makes total sense.
So there's a very interesting pattern going on there. It isn't enough to have massive exposure before the voters. You have to have a message that the voters are willing to tap into. And that is really the key thing here. What's basically happening is, despite the fact that the major media have been, let's be honest, treating Ron Paul as the invisible candidate, or as what's his name at Comedy Central, Jon Stewart described it, Ron Paul is the 13th floor on a hotel.
You know? Yeah, the 13th floor. Right?
I thought that was a good description. But, you know, but despite the fact that he's gotten virtually no coverage, I mean, somebody calculated he had like 2% of the available coverage for Republican presidential candidates over the past year. Despite the fact that he's been virtually ignored, he just said, well, the heck with all that. We're just going directly to the voters. And that's what he's been doing in Iowa, and it's paying off.
Yeah, and it
paying
might
off
not
better
be
than with any other candidate.
And this lack of media coverage might not be a bad thing when
well,
you consider
course,
what
it,
the media
it turns into a running joke.
Yeah, and what the media has done to Michelle Bachmann and now probably Herman Cain and, you know, Rick Perry, you know. So, although, you know, there's way too much integrity there. I don't know what they can do to Ron Paul because he hasn't changed his tune in 30
years. Well, that's just it's hard to crack down on him because he's not a flip-flopper.
Which is probably why they kind of ignore him.
Well, of course, yeah. Well, he's not newsworthy. He hasn't said anything new. It's the same thing he's been saying for 25 years.
Yeah, and he can actually remember that stuff.
That's right. So anyway, we've talked far longer about that than I wanted to, but I think that's really an important and impressive thing because he really is set up for a very significant showing in Iowa, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if he wins it.
That would be great.
With only 6 weeks left, it's not a whole lot of time for him to have the same kind of skyrocket effect, so it's very, very possible.
Uh-huh.
Federal Housing Authority, very important stuff here. For the longest time now, dating back to the early part of the financial crisis, the FHA has been assuring us over and over again, you know, they and Ginnie Mae have been assuring us, nope, we're not in the same boat. We're in much better shape. We're not going to have the same kind of problems that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac had. We don't have the same kind of credit default swaps. So yada, 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 yada. Well, guess what? Turns out the Federal Housing Administration, which guarantees now around a third of all U.S. mortgages, faces dwindling cash reserves and could require, say it softly, a taxpayer bailout, according to a forthcoming study by Joseph Giorgio, a professor at the Wharton School. The Wall Street Journal reported that the study predicts that the FHA will lose $50 billion over the next few years. And while the agency is unlikely to go bankrupt this year or next, continued economic woes could lead to substantial losses for American taxpayers. This comes from the International Business Times. I don't know how many times that we've said this in the past, but we have mentioned before every single major lending agency that the government is involved in is at risk here. And I don't know if I should say that it's heartening or it's sad to mention that now it looks like the FHA and Ginnie Mae are in trouble. But, hey, it looks like Ginnie Mae and FHA are in trouble.
And Fannie Mae just asked for, what, another $7 billion? Is that what it was?
Yeah, something like that, yeah. And that's, like, ongoing with them. They're asking for new money every week, practically.
Oh, yeah. I don't know what the total is. And, of course, Newt Gingrich got the $1 million payout for his consulting.
Yes.
Freddie Mac, I think it was, during the housing crisis. And he of course, has been critical. And I think he's even said, Larry, we got to get rid of these agencies many times, but keep paying me.
That's right. Keep paying me to tell you how to keep surviving and how to do well with conservatives.
Yeah.
That's what he was saying.
God.
It's unbelievable. Meanwhile, we're only about halfway through the foreclosure crisis. Did you know that? We've actually reached the halfway point. It's amazing. But according to MSNBC, the foreclosure crisis is halfway over. That's roughly the message from the latest data on home foreclosures and delinquencies released by an industry association on Thursday. The pace of new home foreclosures edged up again in the third quarter, and the number of borrowers falling behind on their payments eased a bit, according to the Mortgage Bankers Association. The good news is that the rate of borrowers who had fallen 3 or more months behind on their payments had dropped to about 3.5% of all mortgages. That's down from a peak of 5% in late 2009, but it's still 3.5 times the normal rate of about 1% that was available before the mortgage meltdown hit.
Yeah, I heard somewhere they thought it would go on until 2014, I think. To 2014, 2015, the foreclosures would finally be all out in the market and sold.
And anytime you hear numbers like that, you can always pretty much double them because, you know,
well, they're just guessing.
Yeah, they're guessing. And they usually try to guess on the side that makes it sound, you know, rosy and wonderful, which means they're usually wrong.
Yeah, I mean, they can predict how fast they'll be bought up pretty much by how much is being sold this year and last year, but they can't predict how many will go into foreclosure because they just don't know that. It depends on the economy. So.
And that's actually what's been happening. More and more people, in fact, we reported on that, I think last week or the week before, how the mortgage industry was surprised at how many more filings there were and how many more people were becoming delinquent because that wasn't supposed to happen. And, of course, the reason it was happening is because people were losing their jobs. They couldn't keep making the payments.
Yeah, if you don't have a job, you don't have a payment. But you know what's interesting is what has kept it from being even worse is the fact that rents have actually strengthened. If rents would have dropped with the deflation, you know, deflationary aspects of the crisis, everybody would have left their house.
Yeah.
You know, I have close friends who are staying in their house because the payment's $1,400. Well, if they had to pay rent on the same house, it'd be probably more.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So they're just looking at it as rent. And if rents would have dropped, if rents were cheap right now, because, you know, everything else should be cheap, it would be twice as bad as it is.
But, of course, they can't drop because when all those people lose their homes, they got to live somewhere.
Yeah,
that increases the demand for houses that are rentals. So,
and there's so many vacant houses that aren't doing anything.
That's right, yeah. So it would be nice if it was a nice, smooth, you know, steady decline for everything because that would make it easy to everybody to understand. But that's not the way it works, unfortunately.
No, it happens really fast.
And it's one of the reasons why it becomes such a bad idea to have a monetary system that creates all this kind of thing, because there's all kinds of terrible stuff that happens when this kind of crisis hits, and then when it plays itself out over the course of years, particularly when nobody wants to actually take the steps that need to be taken to prevent these things from happening again.
No, keep pushing it into the future.
It's a very sad thing, no doubt about it. Oh, by the way, we were talking about the candidates. I got to go back to this headline because I thought that was a great one that you pulled up. What was this headline about Herman Cain and God?
Herman Cain and God, yes. Cain says God made him run for president.
Wait, was it like a direct order? Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's fairly direct, yes. I don't know if he saw him. I don't know if he walked up to the top of the mountain or anything. But anyway, Republican Herman Cain said God convinced him he should enter the race for president. In a speech to a national meeting of young Republicans, Cain said the Lord persuaded him after much prayer. The quote is, "That's when I prayed and prayed and prayed. I'm a man of faith. I had to do a lot of praying for this one, more praying than I've ever done before in my life. And when I finally realized that it was God saying that this is what I needed to do, I was like Moses. You've got the wrong man, Lord. Are you sure?" Once he made the decision, Cain said, he did not look back. It goes on to say that Cain mentions the four women that had come out, kind of ties it in the morality aspect. But anyway, Cain isn't the first to say God prodded a candidate towards the campaign. Texas Governor Rick Perry's wife, Anita, has said she felt God was speaking to her about the presidential race.
Good grief.
Cain went on to criticize President Barack Obama for canceling the space shuttle program, a decision actually made by President George Bush. Anyway, apparently God told him to run for president.
Well, that's good to know. Of course, our engineer just texted me a message that pointed out that God also told that guy to take a shot at the White House the other night. So God seems to have
God says a lot of things.
I tell you. Well, unfortunately, we've reached the end of the hour. But, Gene, it's been a crazy but enjoyable time as usual.
It has.
And we will see you all next week again here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye, everybody.